I was thanking the Arbitzfeld family for everything that they continue to do for Kollel Medreshet Yom Rishon. And I want to thank particularly for our program today. Is it not working? It's not that high. It's working. You have to come stand right next to me, Rabbi Mordechavitz, in order to be able to hear me, I guess. Okay, we'll try to turn it higher. For today in particular, I want to thank Robin and Shuki Grossman and their family for sponsoring today's Yom Iyun. They are here in the audience. I want to thank them particularly for their generosity. They actually have a little bit of a connection, more than just an expression of their generosity for Yeshiva University, and that is that they were members of the Jewish Center when I was the rabbi. They came after Rabbi Young left, but they still clearly benefited from and were influenced by the aura of Rabbi Young within our shul. So we thank Mishpachat Grossman for their graciousness this morning. I also want to thank Nechama Cohen, Rabbi Mordechai Schiffman, Rabbi Rob Shore, and Yoni Cohen on the staff of the CJF for all the work that they did to ensure the success of today's program. I also want to thank all of the participants who will be following me in the various sessions, and I invite all of you. It's a plethora of brachos to make the very difficult decision to choose which program to attend after I'm finished. I also want to welcome and acknowledge the presence of Anne Etra, who is the granddaughter of Rabbi Young, who is joining us here this morning. It's really very special to have you, and we welcome you. We gather today and this coming week, and yesterday at our shul at the Jewish Center, we gathered in commemoration of the 25th Yortzeit of Harav Eliyahu ben Harav Meir Tzvi, Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, Zichrono Levracha. It's important, I think, for us as American Jews and for us with a connection to Yeshiva University to appreciate who it was and what came before us to enable us to reach where we are today. Rabbi Young, who served as the rabbi of the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side of Manhattan from 1922, when he first came to the shul, and then a senior rabbi, and then as rabbi emeritus, until he died in 1987, 25 years ago, the same shul for 65 years, not only had a tremendous influence, obviously, on that shul, but from that perch was able to have a tremendous impact on American Jewry, tremendous impact on world Jewry, and also on Yeshiva University. Rabbi Young brought a great deal of elegance and luster to Orthodoxy in America and made Orthodoxy fashionable and relevant in America long before we have all of the tremendous brachas that we have. We don't really necessarily appreciate how difficult it was 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, what it meant to be an Orthodox Jew in America. We didn't have many beautiful shuls. We didn't have day schools. We didn't have beautiful mikvaos. We didn't have a plethora of restaurants. We didn't have all of those items that we consider to be so central and that we simply take for granted in our lives today as Orthodox Jews. Well, we are where we are because we're standing on the shoulders of giants who came before us, who made that possible before it was easy and when it was complicated and difficult, and they had to stand up against the tide to represent the values of Orthodoxy. And that's why we owe such a tremendous hakaras hatov to those individuals, and in particular today to Rabbi Young for making all of this possible. Just a little bit of a brief biography, and then I want to go into a little bit about Rabbi Young's particular relationship with Yeshiva University in honor of Poschen Bechvod Achsanya. That's where we are today. And then reflect a little bit on one aspect of the nature of the interrelationship between Judaism and general culture, which was at the hallmark of Rabbi Young's life. He was born in 1892 in the Hungarian city of Ungerischbrod. He studied in many yeshivas in Czechoslovakia. He grew up in a very traditional home and went off at some point to study at the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin. He often would tell us stories about his teachers at the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary's experience there, and one of his three smichos he received from Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, who was technically the rector or the head of the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. At the same time of having a strong traditional background, he also attended a number of different universities, the University of Vienna, University of Berlin, while he was in the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, the University of Marburg. He got two PhDs, the first from the University of Gießen, the second from the University of London, also studied at the University of Cambridge, it's Cambridge University. So clearly there's somebody here who's deeply steeped in Torah values, in traditional Jewish life, in orthodoxy, while at the same time deeply steeped at the highest levels in general education, in the culture and the values of the world around us. And it was that combination that he was able to bring to the United States when he came here in 1919 to serve as a rabbi in Cleveland. The first time Rabbi Young came to the United States was as a rabbi in Cleveland. He was a rabbi in Cleveland until 1922, when he came to the Jewish Center, when he came to Manhattan, and really developed himself a national and international reputation. The ability to be able to frame traditional values with elegant English, with sophisticated ideas, with an understanding of and references to the culture. He was an anomaly at that time. Today we take it for granted. It simply didn't exist at that time. And he represented orthodoxy at its highest, at its most elegant. He introduced top hats to be worn by the clergy, by the president, by the lay leaders of the Jewish Center. Today it's a little bit of an anachronism. But in those days it meant so much. It meant so much to show that orthodoxy could be sophisticated, could be elegant, could appeal to the highest levels of the culture of American Jews. The first reference on the first sheet, I hope all of you have a copy of the sheets, comes from a letter that Rabbi Young sent while he was still in Cleveland in the Knesset Israel congregation on May 24th of 1922. And it's the first reference that I found in his archives that relates to Yeshiva University. There was no Yeshiva University in 1922. It was Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. And he writes a letter to a Konigsberg family in New York, a very prominent, well-known family in New York, asking them to take under their wings a young boy from Cleveland who's very poor, who wants to come to study at Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, but simply can't afford to do so. So first of all, it shows the connection that Rabbi Young had with our yeshiva. He wanted to send a young boy from Cleveland to study Torah in our yeshiva. And it also shows the kindness and the chesed that he expressed by wanting to make sure that this young boy is able to do so and will have his needs taken care of. Dear Mrs. Konigsberg, today I come with a bakasha. At the Yitzchak Elchanan Yeshiva studies a young child, the son of a Cleveland Talmud Chacham. This is May of 1922. The father is personally known to me as a very fine Yehudi, very poor. I understand that the boy very often starves and that he has nobody to care for him. Would you be good enough to do that? If you or one of your friends could invite the boy for all Shabbos meals and make him feel at home, you would be performing a very great mitzvah. Let me add that the boy is somewhat proud. In other words, he did not inform his father of his frequent inability to buy a meal. The latter indirectly heard about it. And that, in case it is not yourself that will mother him, it will need some gentle tact, etc. Will you please make an exception and answer this letter? He complained that earlier he didn't get a response from her. I would greatly appreciate it. The boy's name is, and I crossed it out, of Cleveland, with all good wishes to yourself and to Mr. Konigsberg and to all the little ones. Very sincerely, yours, Leo Young. Rabbi Young, shortly thereafter, by Rosh Hashanah of 1922, he was already the rabbi on the Upper West Side of Manhattan at the Jewish Center. And a little bit after that, next page in 1931, was offered a professorship of Jewish Ethics at Yeshiva College by the then President Bernard Revel. We have a copy of the letter of appointment from Dr. Revel to Rabbi Young. It's dated January 4th, 1931. If you look at the stationery is interesting. On the top right-hand side, Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, Nosta Shnas Tafresh Nun Vav, which is 1896. Top left-hand side, Yeshivas Eitz Chaim, Nosna Shnas Tafresh Memvav, 1886. So Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan was a further outgrowth of Yeshivas Eitz Chaim. The earliest iteration of what is now known as Yeshiva University began in 1886 with Yeshivas Eitz Chaim in New York, and then it developed into Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, and then it became Yeshiva College, and then it became Yeshiva University with the fullness of all of the various schools that are now part of our university. The bottom, all the way at the bottom of the stationery, and I want to come back to that in a moment, there's a pitch. Establish a trust with the Yeshiva Endowment Foundation and become an everlasting supporter of the yeshiva. So the way YU was raising money, it wasn't YU then, the way Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan and Yeshiva College, those are the two names that appear at the top of this stationery, was raising money by having people write out a check to, quote, the Yeshiva Endowment Foundation. Yeshiva went through very difficult times. The fiscal challenges that we face are not new, and in fact were highly more significant early in the 30s and in the 40s. In the wake of the Depression, and even in a number of years after the Depression, there were tremendous challenges. And it actually wore down Dr. Revel. Dr. Revel died in 1940 at the age of 55. He was a young man when he died. He was the founding president of Yeshiva College. He was our leader, the first president of what became Yeshiva University. And he struggled mightily with the challenge of just keeping the yeshiva afloat. I have a telegram that Dr. Revel sent to Rabbi Young in 1940. It's on the right-hand side of that second page. From a sick bed. This was shortly before he died. He died on December 2nd, 1940. From a sick bed, I turn to you and devoted friends of yeshiva, Messrs. Golding, Levy, and others, in present yeshiva emergency. Stop. Urgent to save home of yeshiva, honor and future of Torah Jewry everywhere involved. And he's begging Rabbi Young to do what he can to try to raise money. There's a tremendous challenge. And at the end, Dr. Revel shortly thereafter succumbed. And I believe it's quite clear from the tension and the pressure of what it was that he had to face. The top of the next page, there's a letter with the same stationery from Samuel Levy, who was the chairman pro tem of the board of trustees of Yeshiva College and Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. This is dated June 10th, 1940. Dear Dr. Young, it's addressed to Rabbi Young at the address of the Jewish Center, 131 West 86th Street. The mortgage situation of the yeshiva remains very critical, and it is important that our board of directors know of it. It's even more important, it's not only enough to know about it, but it's more important to do something about it. So we need your help. A meeting of the board of directors will therefore be held on Tuesday evening, June 18th, at the Jewish Center, 131 West 86th Street, at 8:30. And it was the Shas HaKosher. It was the Shas HaKosher. War is already underway in Europe. The economy is under tremendous stress in the United States. There is this yeshiva that's desperately struggling to stay alive. It was at that time that a strange, unfamiliar gentleman started to show up for davening at the Jewish Center. He would come every Shabbos. He was of foreign background. And the Rabbi Young got to know him. After Shabbos, after davening, he would give Rabbi Young a yasher koach for the sermon. He didn't really get to know him very well. He saw him a couple of weeks, and then he stopped coming. And he traced him down to his hotel room and find out that that person is really deathly ill. Rabbi Young goes to visit him. His name was Enrico Garda. He was an ambassador from the Republic of San Marino, which is an enclave in central Italy, to France. So I didn't know that enclaves within countries can have their own ambassadors. I'm not sure exactly what this is, but clearly he was a very distinguished fellow, took a liking to Rabbi Young. Rabbi Young came to see him. He was deathly ill. They began to talk. Rabbi Young shared with him the pressures and the tensions of the various needs that the Jewish community has. And Enrico Garda asked his secretary to give Rabbi Young a check. And the check was for $50,000. And at the bottom of that page, I have the check that Rabbi Young made out to, and now you realize why I mentioned it earlier, the Yeshiva Endowment Foundation, Inc., for $50,000, November 23rd, 1940. This was an astronomical amount of money. You can only begin to imagine what this meant in 1940. Rabbi Young took the money that he got and gave it to Yeshiva. And I think part of the reason why we're able to be here is because there were people who, at a time of tremendous crisis, were able to stand up and be supportive of the work that our yeshiva was trying to do. And we need to express Hakar Satov to Rabbi Young at a critical moment, came through, and of course, tremendous Hakar Satov to Enrico Garda. Rabbi Young instituted thereafter an award at every single graduation of Yeshiva University called the Mordechai Ben David Award. Enrico Garda's name was Mordechai Ben David, and this continued for many decades as a central feature of commencement at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Young represented not only an Ish Chesed, which he clearly was in so many different ways, but he represented an image and a vision of Orthodoxy that was so unusual and so central and so basic and so important for us to appreciate. There are many more people today who represent that. This university represents that. But in those early years, you can count maybe on a half a hand those individuals in this country who stood for this kind of an elegant, sophisticated, acculturated orthodoxy without compromising ki hu zeh, not one drop on Ruach Yisrael Saba, on the Mesorah, but being able to present it, to articulate it in very sophisticated ways. I'm going to quote now from a little entry that I wrote to an encyclopedia, Oxford University Press in 1999, published a biographical encyclopedia, many volumes. They asked me to write about Rabbi Young. I did not Xerox this for you, but I'm going to read it to you as an introduction to the next part of my presentation. For more than a half a century, Rabbi Young devoted himself to bringing sophistication and dignity to American Orthodoxy. And it's really Zohar Oso Ha'ish Latov. We need to remember. We need to remember everybody who did this. And we have the opportunity today to remember Rabbi Young, Zichrono Livracha. He devoted himself to bringing sophistication and dignity to American Orthodoxy, dedicating his efforts to merging the practices, passion, and piety of traditional Orthodoxy with the new intellectual and cultural worlds of the 20th century. Combining Torah and Tennyson, davening and Dickens, Shabbos and Shakespeare. In his spoken and written words, Rabbi Young argued for the compatibility of Torah true Judaism. That's what he called it. He didn't talk about orthodoxy. He talked about Torah true Judaism. He argued for the compatibility of, quote, Torah true Judaism with modern thought, and through his teaching and personal example, brought new respect to orthodoxy in America. I want next part of the presentation today to focus on one area that I've recently been thinking a lot more about that expresses this interrelationship. And I want to begin with the page after that, and that is the Gemara in Sota on Daf Memches Amid Beis. The next page has a few pictures of Rabbi Young at the top at different stages in his life. But I want to begin with the Gemara in Sota, Daf Memches Amid Beis. The Gemara in Sota here at the very end of Masachet Sota is dealing with the following issue. We know that the Kohen Gadol wore the Choshen and the Ephod. There were various big day kahuna that the Kohen Gadol wore. One was the Choshen, one was the Ephod. The Choshen was the breastplate. And the Ephod was this over garment that had stones on the shoulders. So the Choshen had 12 stones, and the Ephod had stones, and on each of these stones were found, and I'm using that word advisedly, we'll see in a minute, the various names of the Shvatim. So you had Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, the various names of the Shvatim were found on the various stones of the Choshen and the Ephod. The Gemara is interested in trying to understand how did the names of the stones get onto the Choshen and the Ephod. How did they get, we'll use the word, affixed to the Choshen and the Ephod? How did that happen? So the Gemara says, L'chidisanya. There's a little arrow towards like two-thirds of the way down, a few words into the line. L'chidisanya. Avanim halolu en kosven osam bidio. What's the first option? You take ink, you take a quill, and you take ink, and you write it on. Says the Gemara that that's not an option. Mishum shenemar pituche chosam. Because the Torah says that it had to be engraved. It couldn't just simply be written, it had to be engraved. No, so if it has to be engraved, so engrave it. You can't really classically engrave it, because how do you engrave it? Mesartin aleim bi'izemel. You take a little thin iron object that's sharp at the end, and you take a little hammer, and you figure out a way, and you somehow have somebody who's an expert, and you engrave the letters onto the Choshen and the Ephod. That's also not an option, says the Gemara. Mishum shenemar b'miluosam. Because the Pasuk says it has to be complete. And you understand very well that if you engrave that way, you're going to chisel off a few little shtikaloch from the stone. That's how you're going to create the indentation, is by removing, chiseling out, and that's also no good. So the Gemara has a problem. You can't write it on. It has to be engraved. You can't classically engrave it, because it has to be whole. You can't lose any tiny piece of what the stone was. So Gemara says, I'll tell you, here's the way they did it. Here's how they solved the problem. Elakosev eleim bidio. They first outlined it with ink. They put the names in ink. And then, umare lohen shamir mibachutz. Then they brought the heligah shamir. What's the shamir? So now I'm going to say words that I don't understand. The shamir was this mythical, magical little worm. And we know about the shamir. The shamir is what was placed on top of the stones. How did they create stones in the ancient times, in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, the times of the Mishkan? They put the shamir, and the shamir just cut right through the stones. So they had this nest called the shamir. And what did they do now? They outlined it with ink, but that alone wasn't good enough because it had to be engraved. So they put the shamir, and then what the shamir did was it split it open. It split it open. Zok de Gemara, elakos ven aleim bidio, umara lahen shamim bibachutz, vehen nifka osme elehem. And they would split by themselves. The Gemara gives two examples. Kete'eno zu shenifkas biyamos hachama. If you put a date out in the sun, so what's going to happen? After a while, the sun is going to bake down on the date, and it's going to sort of a shtick will explode. It's going to open up. So it opens, and there is this indentation, but it hasn't lost anything, because it just goes to the side. That's exactly what happened here. And the second example in the Gemara is ukebikazu, like the floor of a valley, shenifkas biyemosak shamin ve'ena chaseira klop. That in the winter, the rainy season, it splits open. It forms like a little shtick of a canyon, a little bit open. So it opens and you have the engraving, but you haven't lost anything because it just is to the side. Atkan de Gemara Masachet Sota. This is how they were able to get the names of the Shvatim onto the Choshen and the Ephod. Now let's go back a page to the Halakhot. The Halakhot, the Turei Zahav, Rav David HaLevi, is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, and he lived in the 17th century in Poland. Now I'm going to give you the dates of death of the next four sources that I'm going to introduce to you. Not so much that the specific date is important for you to remember, but I want to show you that there's this chronological development that I would like to share with you. So the Taz died in 1667. The Taz died in 1667. He lived through two of the most cataclysmic events in Jewish history in the 17th century. First, the Gzeros Tach V'Tat, the Chmelnytsky massacres in 1648, 1649. And then towards the very end of his life, he was influenced by and very curious about the whole Sabbatian movement. In 1665, Shabtai Tzvi is announced as the Messiah. In 1666, towards the end, Shabtai Tzvi converts to Islam under pressure. 1667, the Taz dies. The Taz here in Hilchos Sefer Torah is dealing with the question of printing. And the Taz, in the context of Hilchos Sefer Torah, says the following, a little bit right where the arrow is on the left-hand side. I'm retching from various ways. Once we're talking about various ways of how to write a Sefer Torah, so how does one create a Sefer Torah? So you have parchment, and you have ink, and you engage in an act that halachically is called ksiva. Ksiva means you have to write. You have to write a Sefer Torah. That's how you produce a Sefer Torah. The Gemara says, when it comes to a get, for example, a bill of divorce, the Gemara Maseches Gittin on Daf Chaf, the chosav la sefer krisus velo vechokak. That when it comes to a get, you also have to write a get, and you cannot engrave a get. Engraving does not work for a get. So the Gemara sets up these two principles, or these two methodologies, or these two, let's call it, technologies. The technology of writing and the technology of engraving. Writing is the way you write a Sefer Torah. Writing is the way you write a get. Engraving does not work either one of them. Dr. Taz, I'm retching from engraving. Once we're talking about Chakika, I want to say something. Lema be milsa. Lefisha shamati omrim, she'ein bisfarim hanitfasim kedusha, kimo hanichtovim dechsav. Now this is 1667. A fellow in Mainz by the name of Johannes Gutenberg invented printing in the beginning, in the first part of the 15th century. So now we have printing. Now we have Sfarim that are printed. Question, what is the halachic status of a printed sefer? I know there's something called Seamus. What does Seamus mean? We all know about Seamus. Seamus literally means names. And literally, it's a reference to the names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we have to treat them respectfully. We can't throw them out. We put them in, quote, Seamus, and then we have to dispose of them respectfully. It became, to me, not only names of God, but also Divrei Torah. And in the Cairo Geniza, it came to mean anything with Hebrew letters. That's why we have the Cairo Geniza, because even if it has nothing to do with the Dvarim Shebikdusha, if it's a contract between two businessmen that was written in Hebrew letters, it was thrown into the Cairo Geniza. That's what Seamus is. So we have to treat it respectfully. Well, what about a printed book? Does a printed book, a page that's printed, does it require the same respect that something that was written down, Bichsav, requires? And Shamati Omrim, that's not the case. Because printing does not have a halacha of ksiva, and if printing does not have a halacha of ksiva, it shouldn't require the same level of kedusha. And the Taz says that that's not true. V'li nira she'ein chiluk. The Taz says that even something that's printed also requires the sanctity to be treated respectfully with kedusha, and he brings a raya from our Gemara. He brings not just a raya, but he calls it on the line va'od nira li raya berura. I'm going to bring you a clear proof from our Gemara. He quotes the Gemara, and he says, how does the Gemara solve the problem as to how the names of the Shvatim got onto the stones? Because of the Heilige Shamir. The Shamir came, and all of a sudden, a Gevorin engraving without losing anything. Frek the Heilige Taz, V'im Isa, three lines from where the lines get, before the lines get wide at the bottom left of the page. If you're going to say that printing has a halacha of engraving, and since it has a halacha of engraving, therefore it's not considered to be kadosh, like something that's written, and therefore it does not have to be treated so respectfully.
have a chakika kosher. Minolon dahaya al yedei shamir shehu davar she'eino matzui.
How did they solve the problem? How do you know that the way they solved the problem of getting the names of the Shvatim onto the stones is because they had the Shamir? The Shamir is not something which is common. You know, the Shamir was very unusual. Maybe there was a lineup to wait to get the Shamir. Maybe the Shamir was resting. Maybe the Shamir was somewhere else. It's not so pashut to go order the Shamir Zolarain come in and right now do the job that you need. The Shamir was enimotzi. How do you know that it was the Shamir? Dilma hoyo al yedei atfus ubidiyo kidufus shalanu. There's a much simpler way how to solve the problem. Print it right on, just like we have printing. They could have printed it. That's how they could have put the names of the Shvatim on the stones. If you hold that printing is engraving, that's how you solve the problem. You engrave it, and nothing is missing. If you print it on, that's called engraving. I engraved it, and it's still b'milu osam, because I didn't lose anything. I just superimposed it. I engraved it right on top of it. So there's a raya lahalocha zaktataz, that printing is ksiva. Because if printing was not kesiva, if printing was chakika, then they would have used printing to put the names of the Shvatim on the stones. Adkan Dehele Gataz dies in 1667. Next page. Dehele Gachavis Yoyer, Rabbi Yoyer Chaim Bachrach. Top right of the next page. Rabbi Yoyer Chaim Bachrach, Gemen Avei Leyi, the big Talmud Chacham. His whole life revolved around the city of Worms in Germany. His father was the rabbi of Worms, the Zedig Ivan, the grandfather was the rabbi of Worms. When his father died, Satan Norgegangen and Leiden, he only wanted that he should become the rabbi in Worms. The father was the rabbi, the grandfather, he wanted to be the rabbi of Worms. The Balabatim in Worms said, Loi, mitagreisen Aleph, you're not going to be the rabbi in Worms. He was never heartbroken, it's a gewalgert. He traveled, he became old, he became blind. And in 1699, the Balabatim said, okay, now you could become the rabbi in Worms. He's the rabbi in Worms until 1702. He dies in 1702. He's buried in the Beis HaKvaris in Worms. If you go to Worms today, in 2012, there's an incredibly extraordinary cemetery behind the shul in Worms. It wasn't touched. Unbelievable. And there's a really very chashuv matseva for the Chavisyar of Chaim Yar Bachrach. Chaim Yar Bachrach and his Chuvis Chavisyar Simon Kufbe Dalit deals with the issue of printing. And he has a very interesting shayla. You could read it on your own. The question is, what is the status of a printed sefer? And he says, the status of a printed sefer is like kesiva. It's considered to be like kesiva. He agrees with the Taz. However, he says, I do not agree with the proof of the Taz. The Taz brought a proof that it's Ksiva, because, said the Taz, if it was Chakika, they would have used it to print on the letters of the Shvatim on the stone. Says the Chavisyar, what are you talking about? What are you talking about printing? What do you mean printing? They didn't have printing. They didn't have printing then. Zakta Chavisyar, top left, in the last of the underlined sections, Afki Lanias Daiti, Ein Ho Chachos Oklum. He's talking about the Taz. I agree with the Taz Lahalacha, but the proof can't be a proof. What are you talking about? If printing would be Chakika, they would have used printing. What do you mean that you would have used printing? Printing was invented in the 15th century. Mipnesha Lo Yadu Lifnei Shin Shona Me'in Yenatfos. Nobody ever heard of printing before 200 years ago, before 300 years ago. Nobody ever heard of printing. So what's the Raya of the Taz? What's he talking about? What do you mean they would have printed it? They couldn't have printed it. They didn't have printing. So you can't bring a Raya. The fact that they didn't use printing in the Mishkan is a Raya that printing has a particular halachic status. Can't be. They didn't use it because they didn't have it, because it didn't exist. That's what the Chavisyar says on the Taz. Now we move to the bottom right-hand page, to the Hail of the Knesset Yecheskel. Knesset Yecheskel was Rabbi Yecheskel Katzenellenbogen, who was the chief rabbi of the triple community of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. Today, Hamburg is clearly the most substantial of those cities. In the 18th century, it was a combination of Altona
and Hamburg and Wandsbek, known in Hebrew by the Rosh Yeshivas Kehilot Ahu, Aleph Hey Vav. It was a confederated community, and the chief rabbi was the chief rabbi over all three of them. It was known as the triple community. Rebbe Chezkel Katzenelem Bogen was the chief rabbi from the middle teens of the 18th century, 1715, 1716, until he died in 1749. The Taz died in 1667, the Chavis Yair died in 1702, and the Knesset Yecheskel dies in 1749, the chief rabbi of Hamburg. It is his death that leaves an opening in the community, and a balabas in town was named Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yaakov Emden applied for the job. After all, in his case also, the Tate given the chief rabbi, the Zeide given the chief rabbi. He loses the vote to the Rebbe Rabbi Yonason, to Rabbi Yonason Eibshitz, who becomes the chief rabbi after the Knesset Yecheskel, and shortly thereafter we have the explosion of what is known as the Emden-Eibshitz controversy. The Knesset Yecheskel in Simen Lamed Zayin quotes the Chavis Yair, who rejected the Taz. And the Knesset Yecheskel says as follows, U'b'mechilas kvodo, the last of the underlined sections. What does b'mechilas kvodo mean? With all due respect, b'mechilas kvodo. Now, you understand very well that as soon as somebody says to you, with all due respect, you better gatel zechinter and put on a raincoat or armor, because they're going after you. They want to be nice to you, so they say with all due respect, they don't mean it for a second, with all due respect, and then in the kishkes, gleich arayn tief tayer in the kishkes, says the Knesset Yecheskel. Listen to the Knesset Yecheskel's critique of the Chavis Yair's critique of the Taz. U'b'mechilas kvodoy, chazara, the Taz said, I'll bring you a proof that printing has the status of ksiva, because if printing had the status of chakika, they would have used it in the Mishkan to put the names of the Shvatim. Says the Chavis Yair, what are you talking about? They didn't have printing. Says the Knesset Yecheskel, what are you talking about? B'mechilas kvodoy, with all due respect. V'chi Moshe Rabbeinu olav hashalom, asher diber panim el panim. Are you trying to tell me that Moshe Rabbeinu, who spoke to God face to face, u'shlomo, and Shlomo HaMelech, asher olav ne'emar v'yechka mikol adam, who is the smartest human being to ever walk the face of this earth. Are you trying to tell me that they lo yadu lahamtzi chachmas hatfus, that they couldn't figure out how to invent printing, ad shekam chacham umas ha'olam, until some guy had to come and to invent printing? Some chacham umas ha'olam had to invent printing? What are you trying to tell me, that the greatest prophet in the history of humanity, trying to tell me that the smartest genius in the history of humanity couldn't figure out printing? Of course they figured out printing. They could have figured out printing. Why did they not figure out printing? They didn't figure out printing because it wasn't going to help them. They don't need printing, continues the Haleh of Knesset Yecheskel. Elavadei lo havetzorech lehu. The dvarim sheba'al peh, things that were supposed to be oral, lo hayirishon and lichtov, could not be written down. By definition, it had to be oral. So if it had to be oral, what's printing going to help me? It's not allowed to be written down. Udvarim shebechsav, and things that had to be written, hoya tzorech dafka al klaf uksav kesefer Torah. Printing writer isn't going to help me. So the reason why they didn't invent printing is because it would not have helped them to put the names of the Shvatim on the stones. Because if it would have helped them, namely, if it would have had the halacha of chakika, they wouldn't need the shamir. The Taz is right. What are you talking about, Chavis Yair? They didn't have printing. Forgive me. They could have invented printing. They were really smart. Some guy has to invent printing. Moshe Rabbeinu and Shlomo HaMelech couldn't invent printing. Of course they could have invented printing. So the fact that they didn't invent printing is because it wouldn't have helped them. Is a raya like the Taz. Is a raya that printing has a halacha of ksav and not chagika. And therefore they didn't invent printing. Now we come to the final piece of this puzzle. And that is the Heilige Maariz Chayes. The Heilige Maariz Chayes Tzvi Yerushchayes dies in 1855. We now jump the century. The Maariz Chayes, bottom left of the page. Reb Tzvi Hirsch Chayes is one of the great Talmid HaChachamim of the 19th century. He was a Galatiana, my kind of guy, Chmelochata Galatiana. He was a Galatiana. His father was a businessman, and his father taught him
not only exposing him to lumdis and shas and poiskim and the Allah nichsei tzayim barzel of to be a Talmud Chacham, but his father also taught him French and German and Italian and other secular subjects. And he, the Maritz Chayes, was one of their earlier, what we call Torah in Derech Eretz, or Torah Umada personalities. He combined a knowledge of and an appreciation of Torah knowledge at its highest level, and also some level of secular studies and secular exposure. The Maritz Chayes, Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, goes after the Knesset Yecheskel, who went after the Chavis Yoyer, who went after the Taz. This is the final piece. Zok the Heilige Maritz Chayes, Va'od, bottom left underlined. Kvodo ha-godol shel ha-rav Knesset Yecheskel b'mekom o-munach. Sounds like b'mechilas kvodo. The Knesset Yecheskel had a lot of kavod, but we're going to stick that kavod in the corner now. Kvodo b'mekom o-munach. And listen to his critique. Udvarov bozeh einam rak min ha-matmihim. What did the Knesset Yecheskel say? Chazara. The Knesset Yecheskel said, of course they could have invented printing. What are you trying to tell me? They didn't have printing? Chavis Yoyer said they didn't have printing, and that's why they didn't do printing? They could have had printing. They were smart people. They could have invented printing. The fact that they didn't is a riot that it wouldn't have helped them. Zakti Maritz Chayes, this is wondrous that he could say this. Velozeh haderech lefalpel kazeh. This is not the way how to write. Especially b'mashen ogeh lo tzoras hadinim. There's a halachic nafkamina here. The nafkamina is, does printing have the same kedusha as ksiva? So can I print to get? If I have printed sefer, do I have to put it into Seamus? This is not just some theoretical exercise. This has normative halachic significance. Zog the Maritz Chayes, this is not an appropriate way how to argue when it comes to something that is halachically significant. The MS, he says, you're right. Of course you're right, says the Maritz Chayes to the Knesset Yecheskel. Of course, ki Moshe Rabbeinu lo kam kamoso b'nevuah. There was never a prophet as great as Moshe. Shlomo lo kam kamoso b'chachma. And Shlomo was taka the greatest chacham ever. Of course. However, ulam, Hashem Yisbarach Hevet V'Roa Meireshes. God already set up in advance. Ugevulos cholak l'cholas manim v'hadoros l'hashlomas ha-chochmos. And he set up certain boundaries in each generation, one after another, for the unfolding. I'm going to call it the unfolding of human knowledge. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu in advance set up a whole world system that will unfold generation after generation when it comes to knowledge. And not all times, not all generations, not all decades, not all centuries are identical. Sometimes they are very weak. And nothing really is going on. And sometimes there's a lot going on, a lot changes. Sometimes nothing happens. Take a look at medieval history from the year 500 to the year 300 to the year 1400. So the Zelba Behema and the Zelba schlepping and the Zelba drinking water from the well. Nothing's going on technologically in the world for 700 years. Nothing is really changing. And then take a look at the last 10 years. The last 10 years, there's an explosion. There's mamash an explosion. I live in the dark ages because I have a BlackBerry. My grandchildren take my BlackBerry and they go like this. They go like this. And Gunish, and they're looking at me like, Zadie, what's wrong with you? If you can't go like this and like this, it's a bracha levatola. I before quoted and I Xerox for you a telegram. A telegram? Tell your students today, tell your children and the grandchildren, explain to them a telegram. In the last couple of years, and it's mamish yesterday, the explosion of the internet, the explosion of all of these, the I this and the I that and the I this, it's amazing. So for 700 years, mezitzt, eingeleicht in the same way that we were, and in 6 minutes, the whole world explodes and changes. That's what the Maritz Chayes says. There is a particular method
for the unfolding of human knowledge. Ve'ein lo chadavar she'ein lo zman u'makom. Everything has its time, and everything has its place. Va'akol beritzon Hashem yizbarach, shehu korei hadoros meirosh. So you're right, says the Maritz Chayas to the Knesset Yechezkel. Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest, Sheva greatest, of course. Like, come, kamayhu, panim el panim, no question. Shlomo HaMelech was the greatest genius ever. But it would have been inconceivable for Moshe Rabbeinu and Shlomo HaMelech to invent a printing press, because it just wasn't ready yet. That stage in the unfolding of human knowledge wasn't at that point. It's not a chisaron in their godless, or in their pikchis, or in their nevuah, if they couldn't do this. So therefore, the Chavis Yoyer is right, they didn't have printing. The Chavis Yoyer is right, the Raya of the Taz falls off, and that is, what did the Taz say? The fact that they didn't have printing is a Raya that it's ksiva, not chakika, because if it was chakika, they would have had printing. Zakhtar Maritz Chayes, they didn't have printing, it's not possible. So we have here something really interesting, and it speaks to the interrelationship between the notion of progress, and the notion of the greatest of the great of the great could do anything, and chas v'shalom to say that you are limiting them by saying that they could not have invented something that later some guy decided to invent. And the last page, I just Xerox one paragraph for you. I gave this talk, a version of this talk, a number of months ago for a program sponsored by the Tikva Fund. And there was another member of the conference who was there, another presenter by the name of Alan Jacobs, who's a professor of English at a small liberal arts university, who has a blog on The Atlantic. And he wrote up this presentation for the blog of The Atlantic, and he put it in a very interesting way. And I want to just look at the last paragraph. Rabbi Schachter took us on a virtuosic whirlwind tour of these texts, demonstrating that Karo, the Taz, and their successors became consumed by the question of what we might call the conditions of technological possibility. Why was there no printing press in the time of the patriarchs or of the sages of the Mishnah? Were these not great and wise men, men who talked to God, exclamation point, who could have invented the printing press had they thought it appropriate to do so, or had God so instructed them? And was not their failure to do so an indication that the printing press is to be shunned? Shunned, I think, is a little bit of an overstatement. It means it would have been, it's not relevant. It wouldn't have mattered. It wouldn't have helped them. Some thought so, but others replied, no, not at all. This is the Maritz Chayes. The fact that these men were great sages who knew God did not mean that they could overleap the state of their own age. Technology develops incrementally in any given culture. And even the wisest men of God, and the reference here is, of course, to Moshe Rabbeinu and to Shlomo HaMelech, have no power, as great as they are, panim el panim, vayechka mikol adam, they don't have the power, as great as they are, to escape those conditions. Technological history and sacred history connect and sometimes overlap, but are essentially distinct. And I share this with you in memory of Rabbi Young, because this really speaks to what I think is, in a very interesting way, the whole issue of the intersection and the interrelationship between our Mesorah and the culture of the world around us, the reality of the world around us, and the nature of the connection between how that is going to influence, is going to influence this. Besides being such a foremost spokesman for elegant orthodoxy, Rabbi Young was at his core a tremendous ish chesed, and he was proudest among his many, multiple, just literally endless acts of chesed, both bichlal u bifrat, of the affidavits that he was able to arrange for, to be able to bring those under the knife of the Shoah, before the Shoah and after the Shoah, to come to the United States. He saved some 9,000 people who came to the United States by going to over 1,000 families and getting them to sign an affidavit stated that I am taking achrayas I'm taking responsibility for the economic status of this particular individual or family. Total strangers, obviously people who signed here in the United States, I had no idea who they were signing for. Rabbi Young went to over a thousand people and asked them to sign affidavits, and that's the only way they can come into the United States, because otherwise they would be a ward of the state and the government would not be interested in having them. Just imagine 9,000 people in 1946, 47. Imagine the exponential number of neshamas and nefashos that Rabbi Young just gave life to. It's probably in the hundreds of thousands already at this time, and that's just one tiny example of his chesed. There's halacha when it comes to Chanukah. The Mishnah Berurah says in Siman Tov Reish Ayin Aleph, V'emein lo shemen b'tzimtzum al kol hashmona yamim. If somebody, im yesh lo shemen b'tzimtzum al kol hashmona yamim, let's say I have enough for eight days to light, ulachavero ein lo klum. So I went to the store and I bought that kit, and that has pre-poured and pre-waxed. The Allah get the zachi, just slip it right in, and I'm all set for one, the first night, two, the second night, three, the third night. But then I find out that somebody down the block, Nebuch, doesn't have because they can't afford. Mutav shiyadlik b'chol laylo echad v'yiten gam l'chavera. It's better for me to light one the first, one the second, one the third. The Gemara says that the mitzvah of Chanukah is ne'er eshubeis, so it's only the Mahadrin min ha-Mahadrin, that we add one each night. But don't do the mitzvah Mahadrin min ha-Mahadrin. Better give it to your friend that your friend can have. And this notion of trying to be mitzamtzem yourself, trying to limit yourself out of a deep sense of sensitivity to the other, and having a deep sense of sensitivity to the other, even if it doesn't mean having to be mitzamtzem yourself, was at the core, the hallmark of Rabbi Young's life. The chesed that he did for us at Yeshiva University, the chesed that he did for us at the Jewish Center for our shul, and the chesed that he did for American Jewry and for World Jewry. I want to conclude with reading for you the very last paragraph of Rabbi Young's autobiography. Rabbi Young wrote an autobiography. It's really very, very interesting. The last paragraph he wrote as follows. As one grows older, one's horizon becomes larger. There is an increasing sense of loneliness. Not only close relatives, but friends of one's youth, adolescent, and maturity in increasing numbers go to their eternal reward. Rabbi Young died when he was 95 years old. He died in 1987. He was born in 1892. He died when he was 95 years old. Until 2 weeks before he died, he was walking around Manhattan. He was visiting people in the hospital. He was absolutely, totally sharp, totally physically active. And he writes that as you get older, you get a little bit more isolated, you feel more isolated, and everybody around you is no longer with you. They all have been called to the Olam HaEmes. It is only steadfast loyalty to the welfare of the Jewish people and to the imperishable glory of the Torah that keeps one dynamic, optimistic, and at peace with oneself. Long ago, Rabbi Tarfon said, "It is not upon you to finish the work, but nor may you ignore your responsibility." I feel sure that there are enough men and women in the camp of Israel to take the flag from one's weakening hands, to uphold it, to salute it, to work for it, and to initiate a happier chapter of Jewish and general history. We commemorate 25 years since the passing of this great giant, an era certainly has come to an end. Rabbi Young lived a long and full and beautiful and meaningful life, and now the flag is in our hands. We should be worthy of holding that flag and following in his footsteps. Harav Eliyahu ben Harav Meir Tzvi, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Tehei Nishmaso Tzrura, Tzurar HaChayim. Thank you.